Hi, and welcome to this special episode of the Platform Podden podcast. As you might have noticed, this episode is in English, and that is because we have a very special guest with us today. Matthew Skelton is the co-author of the famous Team Topologies book and CEO and principal at Conflux. I first became familiar with the DevOps movement through the DevOps Days conferences, and later learned about the different DevOps topologies and how not to do DevOps with the DevOps antitypes through the work of Matthew. This work led to the book that many of our listeners, including Audun and myself, know as the Team Topologies book, which describes the four fundamental team types: stream-aligned, enabling, complicated subsystem, and the platform team, and their interaction modes, collaboration, and as a service, and or facilitating. So to kick us off, Matthew, can you tell our listeners how all of this got started way from the DevOps topologies?
Sure, and thanks for inviting me. I'd just like to say it's great to be here, and hello to all your listeners. Yes, so DevOps topologies. So let's take a journey back in time. Climb into our DeLorean and press some buttons, right? And so back in 2013, so this is now more than 10 years ago, because we're recording this in 2024. What is it now? Middle of January 2024. So more than 10 years ago, 2013, I was working in an organization in London, and it's a big retailer. Well, it's a retailer, and the sales volumes are quite substantial. But there's about 300 people working in this organization at the time. So not huge, but also not absolutely tiny. And the organization was on the start of a journey towards cloud. At the time I joined, they still had everything in physical data centers that they managed. I think they probably managed for them. But anyway, there was a sense in which there was certainly no cloud, very little use of cloud at the time. Anyway. The two main groups in technology being kind of development and operations. We were on the same floor of the building, but we were physically separated. One, operations at one end and development at the other. So there's a kind of dev and ops divide. And that was reflected in kind of the ways of working and different incentives and all of the stuff that we now know about from the whole DevOps movement that's been around since, 2008 or so. And looking at the different kind of interactions and possibilities for working better together prompted me to think through, well, are there some patterns that we can try and establish here? Because, hey, we could try and work really well together by effectively blending all of our activities. Let's work on everything together. Well, that could work. What about if we just worked on certain things together, maybe like logging or deployment or something like this? That could also work. It would have a different feeling, different trade-offs, but it could also work. What happens if, in actual fact, the development was kind of responsible for all of the runtime success of the services that that development's building, and operations sort of provided some underlying set of techniques and tools and services instead that we could use? That could also work, and so on and so on. Thinking through lots of different kind of ways of working in these two different complementary skills groups. And that led to me writing a blog post. It was October 2013. I wrote this on my personal blog. It's still there. It still gets like 1,000 page views a month, which for my little blog is great. And I used Venn diagrams. We used Venn diagrams to try and articulate some of these possibilities. Some of the ideas actually came together through a couple of people that I was working with at the time. We did some workshops, early kind of DevOps-focused workshops in and around London. One guy was called John, another was called James. We did some really interesting stuff together. It's kind of in-person workshops exploring different ways of thinking about kind of collaboration and this sort of thing. Some of the ideas came from there too. Anyway, I end up with some Venn diagrams, so overlapping circles, or perhaps circles that don't overlap. So, Hans, you mentioned the anti the kind of antitypes. So that's where we don't have any overlap or relationship between, say, development and operations. And the two groups are really quite separate and don't interact at all. And that's quite clearly an antitype because we need some connectivity between them, otherwise things fall down the gap. Anyway, so I put this blog post, published a blog post back in October 2013. And it was picked up by quite a few different places. It went a bit viral. Generated lots of discussion and led to lots of additional kind of language and terminology and so on and so on. Through that work on those DevOps topologies, so a series of patterns that focused on development and operations working together, through that work I met a person called Manuel Paish, who is now my co-author on the Team Topologies book. At the time, he was, amongst other things, he was an editor at InfoQ. InfoQ being the organization that runs the QCon events. Odum, where you spoke on the track that we were together in 2022, right, in London, yes. With Trolls. And anyway, I met Manuel back in like 2015, and we worked together on some stuff, and he included some of the DevOps topologies patterns in, I think, an InfoQ ebook. And then we actually started working together on customer work because our kind of perspectives were really closely aligned. We started kind of trying to work through these DevOps topologies patterns with customers we were working with at the time. And we actually were commissioned by a huge Chinese technology company. I think they had 70,000 people worldwide to kind of expand on the DevOps topologies patterns and think through, well, how does this work at kind of, you know, global scale? So we did quite a lot of research. We found loads more patterns. We looked at alternatives around Less and Scrum and different flavors of Agile and blah, 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 all kind of stuff like this. In the meantime, organizations like Condé Nast International, big publishing house, organizations like Netflix had picked up on the team DevOps topologies and publicly said thank you for publishing these because it really helped us to think through how we want to operate at scale. Other organizations as well use the DevOps topologies like Accenture in their consulting work and so on and so on. So the DevOps topologies start to get more and more kind of traction and usage and commentary and people thinking about them and all this kind of stuff. And it calls us to think, well, fine, there's like, I can't remember how many there are about 8 patterns and perhaps 10 anti-patterns. But is there some way of really kind of condensing this or refocusing the intent behind that to help organizations become more effective? And the more work we did, the more we realized that actually, if you want to move quickly at scale or at any sensible scale beyond just a few people, if you want to move quickly, safely, effectively, if you want to do DevOps effectively, then in today's world where technology is changing all the time, where regulations are changing all the time, where trading relationships are changing all the time, then you've got to take into account team cognitive load. You cannot just arrange your organization without thinking about the cognitive load on the people that are building and running these kind of services. So that needs to be a factor. We realized that a few of the fundamentals, like you really need to think about avoiding handoffs. Mm. I mean, that's a kind of a fundamental DevOps principle, really. But need to avoid handoffs, so then your teams look a certain kind of shape. You need to take into account the alignment to kind of business objectives or to business terminology, so kind of domain-driven design type thinking, and a bunch of other things as well. We can't have groups manually inspecting software changes before they go out the door. So the way that organizations used to do like compliance and security and a bunch of these kind of things couldn't be sustained. So anyway, all this stuff, put this in the mix, put it in a big pot, stirred it up, and the Teams Apologies book came out of that effectively. So the original DevOps Apologies with the Venn diagrams or circles were kind of like an inspiration, I guess, for Teams Apologies work. But really, Teams Apologies is a huge step way, way, way beyond those original Teams Apologies patterns, which are quite static, whereas Teams Apologies is very much like a dynamic thing. We're talking about, as you mentioned, Hans, team interaction modes, the ways in which effectively we should think about teams interacting, and that changes over time. That's dynamic. This week we're interacting in one way, next week we're not, we're actually in a different way, and so on. But I think it's fair to say that the Teams Apologies has the 2019 book has a focus on technology teams primarily, and kind of business teams are close to technology teams. But and the, if you like, the proving ground or the way in which we were comfortable making the recommendations in the Teams Apologies book was because we'd been using those DevOps Apologies patterns for many years before that. Six 6 years before the book was published. So we'd already had plenty of time to kind of test them out, understand the pros and cons, which contexts were suitable for one pattern, which contexts were not suitable for another pattern. In the Teams Apologies book, though, effectively, so if you look at the subtitle of the Teams Apologies book, it's Organizing Business and Technology Teams for Fast Flow. So it's specifically about we're making changes. We've got fast flow value. We're making changes to our software systems or to our other services on a regular basis. We've got many tens or hundreds of those changes going live every day. In that context, certain things need to take a particular shape. And so that's what pops out in the Teams Apologies book.
Yeah, so I think I would maybe say it's a bit of an understatement, said this went a little viral. Imagine if the blog post has gone a lot, really viral then. But just the fact that when you write something and then Netflix says thank you, that's a good thing, especially at that time when Netflix was when everyone wanted a copy. But I really like the approach Teams Apologies has to the platform team. But I think for us to have a really good discussion about that, I think it's good if you can give a really short introduction to all the different types of teams and interaction modes, because they kind of pop up when you talk about platforms after a while anyway. Can you just do a short outline of those?
Yeah, for sure. So what we wanted to do with Teams Apologies is provide a bit of a language for people to talk about teams and interactions between them. And we wanted to have the smallest set of things that was still rich enough to capture a decent amount of organizational need, organizational behavior, that kind of thing. Our starting point in Teams Apologies for in terms of types of team is the stream-aligned team. So a team that has end-to-end responsibility for an ongoing service or user journey or something like this, meeting a set of user needs on an ongoing basis. Mixture of skills, quite small. The team, about 8 people. The reason it's small is because that's how we get maximum trust. And if we have maximum trust, then we can move very quickly. We can make decisions together as a team very, very quickly. We don't need to check each person's opinion. We know that we're going to make the same decision as a team because we've taken the time to build that team as a team, not just a collection of people. And because we've got end-to-end responsibility for that service, there's no handoffs. So then theoretically, that's the quickest way we can get stuff into production and the quickest way in which we're going to get information back from production. So telemetry, logs, metrics, observability, all of that stuff. When there's an incident, we get that information back into our team as quickly as possible, which is what we need because 24/7 software services now, you know, this is starting to get, in some cases, it's life and death. Whether it's, if it's medical or if it's a case of someone receiving like a benefit payment and if they're freezing cold because their benefit payment didn't come through, are they going to die? You know, it starts to get literally life and death with some of these services. So it becomes really important to think about this kind of stuff. So let's say, to some extent, in an ideal world, we might have lots of stream-aligned teams all working on services that are nicely separated, with aligned autonomy. They're looking after their service and it's all fine. However, in reality, we can't have that degree of autonomy with teams looking after everything because the amount of cognitive load is too high. So if you've got a team that's looking after that benefits payment service, what do they think about? Do they think about all the security? Could be. Do they think about all the cloud infrastructure? Ooh, that's getting quite big now, particularly if you're using some of the public cloud. Do they think, or if we're not using public cloud, do they think about the data center? Do they think about the diesel generator or the solar power generator that goes behind it? Like, where does it stop? At some point, their cognitive load has to be limited. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to deliver on the actual benefits payment service. And this is a fact anyway. This happens all the time. So you can treat... you would not dream of having to build your own operating system or build your own silicon chip in order to write some code to build a website. That doesn't make any sense. But then, so people deal with this stuff all the time intuitively, but like we wanted to actually make it much more explicit. So we need to deal with cognitive load in some form. And that's where the other three team types come in. So we've got an enabling team, which is a group of experts. They don't actually build anything themselves. They help streamline teams to increase their capabilities, increase their knowledge, increase their expertise with a particular way of working, a new technology, new service, new technique. And the enabling teams are also what's called boundary spanning. So they span across different organizational boundaries. They can detect common problems across multiple different teams and then bring that knowledge, bring that awareness back kind of into the center, if you like, and then we can do something useful with that knowledge. So let's say 17 out of 20 teams have the same problem with this particular, I don't know, data validation thing. I don't know, something. Right, what do we need to do? Well, there's a clear need for some kind of data validation thing, but it's really complicated. Are we really going to push that data validation activity into every single stream-aligned team? Really? No. Let's take that out. Let's take the cognitive load out into what we call a complicated subsystem team because it needs really specialist knowledge. The people doing that data validation have probably got doctorates or PhDs in mathematics and some other bits and pieces like this, or geospatial data or something. Fine. So we're taking away the cognitive load and putting it into that complicated subsystem, but the way in which that subsystem then presents that capability back enables those streamlined teams just to consume it as a service. So friction-free, it allows those streamlined teams just to use that component. There's no messing about. The user experience or developer experience is great. They can use it. It helps them with their flow and helps the streamlined teams to own their service. Good, fine. At some point, though, we might need multiple of these services. Things for managing stuff like cloud infrastructure, managing things like machine learning, could be having to deal with consistent user experience or consistent design. And when we've got a need to provide kind of multiple services like that, that's what we ended up calling a platform. I personally now don't really like that phrase platform. It's not ideal. We are on the Platform Pod and Podcast, so we have to be true to this. I think it's fine, but it just means so many different things to different people. But a platform effectively is doing the same thing. It's improving flow in stream-aligned teams by reducing the extraneous team cognitive load. That's how we see it. So its purpose is around flow and cognitive load reduction, not about shared services, not about saving money, not about a bunch of other things like this, which traditional platforms were focused on. And I think what we've seen is that using a different lens, like a different pair of glasses, to think about the purpose of a platform really helps. The purpose of the platform there is to improve flow in streamlined teams that use it by reducing their extraneous cognitive load. It gives it a mission, effectively. That platform then has internal customers, which are the streamlined teams. But the platform crucially works with those enabling teams to detect missing capabilities. The platform also should be reaching out to those internal customers effectively and asking them what they need. detecting what they need, having conversations, running prototypes with various different teams to work out the best way in which to provide some of these services, or even perhaps to realise that the platform's not going to provide those services and those some capabilities are actually best placed inside Streamline teams. The platform is not there to take orders from Streamline teams to build whatever the Streamline teams want. That is absolutely not the purpose of a platform. And I think, I've certainly started to use the phrase flow platform instead of just platform, because it emphasises that this is not a lump of technology. It's actually, its purpose is around flow, really. So if in the next Team to Bodies book, I think we'll probably end up calling it something like flow platform instead of just platform, I think.
That's very interesting, and it resonates so much with my sort of own opinions about platforms as well. But what I think many of our listeners might really be very interested in is how to get started. And most of them, myself included, have sort of encountered, oh, we're going to make this platform and we are going to take 24 months before anyone can start using it at all. And sort of very upfront and trying to solve all the things at once. Sort of how would Team Topology book advocate towards sort of getting started with a platform? Or
so that particular approach to platform sounds like it's failed already, so I don't do that. I would pose a question like this. I would pose a question like, how far could you get without writing a single line of code? And that's coming from my background as a software developer, right? This is how I started building. I started my career writing software for brain imaging machines and oil and gas industry and then local government and then financial services and a bunch of other things. Like, it's not that I don't like software and code. Like, getting in the zone is amazing. But you pose the question, how far can you get without writing a single line of code? Because you can actually get quite far. Because the starting point can actually just be a wiki page that says, here's a nice way to configure this particular thing, or here are some principles to think about when writing code in our context. That already is reducing cognitive load. It's also by helping people to think about things in a particular way, or by reducing the options that they've got. I don't know how many services exist in AWS, in Amazon Web Services now, but like it's thousands, right? Different products and things you can use. Where on earth does a development team get started with that stuff? So a platform can be, in Team Topology's terms, a platform can actually literally be a wiki page that says, for the kind of services we are building here at our organization, just use these 9 Amazon Web Services. Just use these 9 things. Don't use anything else. We've done the research. Constrain yourself to these things. If you use these 9 things, we as a platform group will support you. That is, and you've not written any code yet. All the heavy lifting is done elsewhere, but what you're doing is curating an experience for those engineers who are using that platform. And only at the point where you really, really need to write some code do you do it. I mean, to be honest, that should be true anyway. Like, it should be true of anything, because code is a liability; it's not an asset. So really start with a kind of minimalist mentality. That's why we in the Team Topology book, why we call. We call it minimum viable platform, because we're trying to make it as, sorry, it's actually not minimum viable platform, it's TVP, it's thinnest viable platform. Hmm. We're trying to create a platform that is as thin as possible. Thin in the sense of the things that we're building in our organization. We're almost certainly using a kind of, we're composing that platform of services from outside or from tools that third-party vendors are providing, and that's fine. The platform can be that curated experience around how to pull those different tools together and how they can work really well effectively together. So I guess that would be my starting point, is how much can we get away with without writing a code? Like, what does the wiki look like? What does that curated experience look like to start with? And that kind of, and keep challenging yourselves around that to keep that platform as thin as possible. In reality, if you're inside an organization of a reasonable size, you'll end up writing some code. It's fine. You will get to write. That's what you like.
Yay!
But the exactly. But the goal is not to like try and build something really fancy. The goal is laser focus on improving flow in the streamline teams with a really good user experience.
So basically, using your own language, we should start as an enabling team, not as a platform team. Because you should try to, and using the facilitating mode when you talk to the teams, and then only when you see you need to scale this out and you need to operationalize it, then you can start thinking about making a platform as such.
Exactly, and that's exactly what some forward-thinking organizations have done in exactly this space. So you might have multiple independent stream-aligned teams. Start with an enabling team, work across those stream-aligned teams, try to understand what the common problems are, and then go, well, looks like there's a specific problem around, I don't know, configuring this thing. Right, let's work out that what that looks like. Let's try and provide that. Let's try and meet that need. Work with the teams, prototype it, get it rolled out, and then iterate from there. But we're not trying to build all the things, because to be honest, by the time you've built all the things this year, half of them will be available in AWS or Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure next year. What's the point? That's just a massive waste of money. Massive waste of time when you can be focused on things that are more central to the organization's mission.
But and that's a fairly good point. I've encountered organizations that sort of have taken sort of don't write any code to heart because they sort of built up this cloud center of excellence and we're going to write thousand upon thousand of wiki pages with sort of this is how you set up everything from scratch, everything under the sun, trying to cover all of the AWS services that can sort of exist.
Well, that makes no sense, right? Because there needs to be a curation there needs to be an opinionated approach to it. And if it's just extra layers of documentation or even extra layers of code, wrapper code around someone else's cloud, what's the point? Just let people get access to the real stuff, but help them by maybe better onboarding or better like configuration files or something that basically smooths their experience and allows them to use their existing experience with AWS. Mm. If you're hiring like an Azure developer or someone, they've already got previous experience, help them use it. But use it in a focused way. Use the platform as a focusing lens to help zoom into what we're trying to do inside the organization. Hmm.
But then when you've kind of gone a further bit down the road and you have this platform team or this group of platform teams, it seems like the platform team should try to organize using team topologies. Like building products, focusing on flow and having stream-aligned teams and having enabling teams and having different kinds of interaction modes as well.
Exactly. Now, at this point, I need to hold my hand up. I'll do it in on the podcast. I'll do it for you on the podcast. You can see it. I'll hold my hand up here. For those of you who are listening on the podcast, I did actually hold my hand up on the video.
I can confirm this.
So we made one mistake in the team topologies book, which was that we listed the platform as one of the four team types. And what we've realized is not really the same kind of thing. Platform is more like a grouping. And certainly, so this year, 2024, we're going to start some work on some new materials around this. So it's effectively, instead of four team types, it's really three team types and a special grouping called the platform grouping.
That kind of breaks the system, though.
Yeah, that's why it's a mistake. So, but we'll do what we can to correct it, basically. But it's still useful to identify the platform as a special kind of grouping, because there'll probably be other kinds of groupings too. Like there might be groupings of streamlined teams if they're working on similar things and so on. But the platform has a specific purpose because its purpose is to improve flow and reduce cognitive load. Whereas other kinds of groupings might not have the same kind of purpose in the same way. So it has got it's still worth calling out as a separate kind of entity. But it's a grouping in the sense that it's like a container for other types of teams. Container for other types of teams and other types of groupings, including other platform groupings. That's the way that we've already seen it. And in the team topologies book, there are some diagrams that show other types of teams inside a platform. But some people don't read past the first two chapters or three chapters of the book, so they don't see it. So yeah, a platform is a kind of container, or you can zoom into a platform and see the same types of teams and activities as you would see outside the platform. So you'll see streamlined teams inside a platform. You'll see enabling teams. You might see a complicated subsystem or two if there's something really awkward in there. Like, I don't know, if you're writing your own authentication, or you're writing your own encryption for some reason, maybe, then you might have like a complicated subsystem in there, because you need people who really, really, really understand that stuff. But you might also have some additional platforms inside that platform. Because kind of the lower level platforms are things like the cloud providers, or if you're running your own data center, you treat the data center as a platform. So that's sitting inside. You can zoom into and zoom out of the view of that platform area. And that's actually really important. So it's a fractal way of approaching organization design. We're using the same principles and patterns at all levels of the organization, effectively, and the same language. So then, whichever, certainly inside IT or technology, but to be honest, outside of IT and technology too, you can use the same language and terminology to talk about the kind of things we're doing. And in fact, we're doing some work with we're doing some amazing work actually at the moment with a green energy company in North America. They're rolling out solar farms and helping citizens to get access to renewable energy. And we're starting to look at how Team Topology applies to their legal department, to their marketing department, to their finance department, but also to their department that is rolling out solar farms. Now, this is all a little bit experimental. We're pretty confident it applies to knowledge work, so the finance and marketing and accounting, legal side. It may also apply in some ways to more physical things, like rolling out solar panels in a solar farm and testing and that kind of thing. We're investigating it. And being able to have the similar language across the whole organization when thinking about cognitive load, flow, team responsibilities, trust, all of this kind of stuff, is proving really interesting, and for some organizations proving really valuable. But yeah, certainly to go back to that platform thing, expecting to zoom into the platform, if you zoom into the platform area, you'll see similar kinds of teams, like streamlined teams. We need to identify our customers. We need to manage cognitive load. We need to think about what our supporting platforms are for those teams inside the platform, and so on and so on. It's a bit like platforms all the way down. Like there's a bit like there's a series, you're stacked on top of a set of other platforms, because at some point the cognitive load is too high. You need to fix some aspects of either technology or services that are provided so that you can do other things. Because otherwise the depth of the stack is too tall, and you have to think about everything. You have to rework everything. Every time something else changes, and it just becomes impossible.
Now
it makes absolute sense.
Continue.
Yeah, it makes absolutely sense, Matthew, because at NAV, we do have multiple platforms. So we have the application platform, we have a data platform, we have a design system, we have a CRM-based platform, we have more infrastructure. So platform is multiple platforms. And being in one of these platform teams, I know for a fact that what you're saying, that there we do have separate authentication subsystem that's complicated in its own way, and there are really high skilled people involved in making that actually work as a service, more or less. There is a fair amount of enabling work that goes into, especially when onboarding new teams to the platform, and in addition to sort of providing the platform as a service, providing documentation, answering support. So yeah, it makes all the sense in my mind that this is a specialized grouping. Absolutely.
We have also seen, at least at NAV, where the in the context of an application platform and migration from older legacy systems to new systems, that when you have when the platform team can send some of the more specialized skilled people out to the Streamline team and basically collaborating with them and helping them do the necessary modernization to be able to move on to a new platform. And I think it speeds up a lot the work, at least we have to do, with migrating to a new, more modern architecture when you have people that don't necessarily know everything about the domain, but they know enough about the platform and the technology to help the Streamline team in that way.
And as they're working there, those experts from the platform, in Teams body terms, we call that an enabling team, like, because it's a temporary thing, probably. But they're able to, but they're working alongside the Streamline team members, and they'll discover some things which are completely surprising. Like, they'll discover a mindset. They'll realize that some people in that Streamline team have a very different way of thinking about something, like databases or data or cloud provisioning or something. And they go, oh, wow, I had no idea that people would think about things that way. Right, we need to change our documentation or our onboarding or our some aspects of developer experience to account for that mindset or that way of thinking, which is hugely valuable, because then it means that we're improving the platform services and experience, that curated experience I talked about before. We're effectively continually curating it as we're working with people in Streamline teams.
And we talked a bunch about the thinnest viable platform and sort of proving the platform or that there are common sort of capabilities here that sort of needs to, that can be sort of the fundamentals of a platform. But what I'm very curious, any advice to how to stay up with what are the evolving and changing needs of the Streamline teams? Because what I see in certain extent, and I can see it internally at Nav as well, that we have some very well-established platform functionalities, and then we sort of end up really, really refining those, and maybe we are sort of missing out on what's the next thing that sort of the platform should
provide. That's a nice, really nice question. So I think there's two broad approaches to this. And these are the same approaches that you'll find in a public cloud provider or any other kind of SaaS or other technology provider anyway. And the two ways, let's call it three ways. The first way is telemetry. So you've got telemetry about how your internal customers are using that platform. So you're looking at the number of API calls, you're looking at the account usage, you're looking about looking at the data egress, ingress, all of this kind of stuff. You're able to detect that automatically, which is useful, that's fine. But then you need to have actual conversations with, like, the product people and the technical people inside the Streamline teams. Like, what are you doing? And what do you need? What's not working? Can we just have some time together? Just as you would do with key customers, if you're a cloud provider or some other technology provider. You go and have those conversations, you go and do that discovery. You might do some joint projects together. I say, hey, we've got some experimental stuff around this. What should we do? I don't know, some machine learning thing. And you find a Streamline team that's willing to invest a bit of time in it because they see there's something in it for them. And the platform knows there's something in it for the platform because there's opportunity to provide something that's really valuable. So you might just do a little bit of kind of, you know, research and development or skunk works or something like this, where you do a little bit of investigation, just as a cloud provider will do. Yeah. But the third thing is much less technology centric, much less product centric. The third thing is social approaches to this. Internal talks, even things like the tech radar that you've got at Nav there, which is just amazing. Like, I love it. I totally love the tech radar thing. Your approach to the tech radar is just amazing. But lunchtime talks. How do you persuade people to come in from outside Oslo into the centre, or even from Bergen? Right? How do you persuade people to come in and do a talk in somewhere central? Well, provide some food, like have a budget for food and make it a social thing. Extend that out so that you've got a program of internal. You've got an internal conference program, like every year or every 6 months. You're coaching people to talk about what they're doing, and you're using all of that conference approach to share information in a really compelling way with other people, to help people realize what's special, help people realize that they've done something that's actually worth talking about, collect the charts, write the story, get some help in presenting skills, get some help in creating the slides in a way which is compelling. So, you know, we're not using like 12-point font and really impossible graphics. We're using something which actually is really appealing to people, and tell a story and share it. So yeah, I think there's kind of standard technology approaches, the standard product management approaches, but there's also the social approaches, which are much less obvious to lots of technologists. And the social approaches can actually be the ones that trigger and encourage the most powerful change and awareness, I think.
So I know we said platforms was going to be the main topic of them. I just have one question. Have you had any adoption of these patterns and this way of thinking outside of the technology space in other kinds of businesses or in other kinds of organizations?
Yes, it's been really interesting. So I mentioned we're doing this work with this with an energy provider, and they've got several different departments looking at it. But we also know of organizations in the legal sector, so like a law firm, looking at using these team patterns to help them think through how to provide legal services in a way which is, you know, more modern and more customer centric. Because certainly in the UK, the traditional model was you had legal specialists in different areas, like business law, family law, property law, blah, blah, blah. But if you had somebody coming along, let's say we've got a woman who is, she's got two children, she's a business owner, she's going through a divorce and she needs to move house. Mm. That's at least three or four separate areas of law. Mm. And traditionally she would be bounced from one specialist practitioner to another one inside the law firm. Like, that's the worst user experience ever. Why would anyone want to do that? Why not try and arrange things so that we can meet her needs, which is, you know, to move house and deal with her shareholding in the business and make sure that the children are safeguarded all together. Like, it's not impossible. It just means you have to rethink how we offer those legal services from inside the organization. But then how do we use that legal expertise? Because some of this stuff is quite complicated. Do we use the expert lawyer as like an enabling team, or try to codify some things as like a complicated subsystem? I don't know. This is what this law firm is investigating. So it's interesting, and it does seem to apply to knowledge work. Interestingly, so we started using the phrase team cognitive load back in 2018 as we were starting to talk about the book the year before it was published. That round about the same time, certainly in English language, the phrase team cognitive load started to be used in the medical profession completely independently. Mm. As a medical profession, it's really interesting. The more handoffs there are between different groups of medical professionals, the greater the chance that someone's going to die. This is properly life and death. I can't remember what the statistics are, but it's something like if there's four handoffs in certain kind of emergency situations, if there's like four handoffs, then the chances of dying goes up by 50% or something like this. So like, they have got a real problem to solve, which is we need to avoid handoffs, because if we hand off this patient to another group, their chance of dying is going to increase. Let's keep them in the same group. But then you've got all kind of different kind of medical specialisms needed and complications. And then can we really learn how to operate an X-ray machine inside this group? That feels like too much cognitive load. So they're dealing with similar kind of problems, but well outside of technology. Mm. And we had, in the UK a couple of years ago, we had like a deputy director of doctors, a part of the health service in the UK, in Wales, part of the UK. And she was like, oh, Teams Bodies seems great for organising like doctors' surgeries, doctors' practices. Let's apply it to the whole of the health service in the UK. And that was just like an off-the-cuff statement on social media. But people can see the value of using the patterns in very different contexts. And it is this year, 2024, is when we're really starting to find those cases and work with people to understand where the edges are, where the patterns don't apply, because they won't apply everywhere. And maybe we need to slightly tweak the change the terminology a bit. I don't know. But this is what we're focused on this year, is finding these situations outside of IT.
It's really amazing to hear you talk, Matthew, and I wish we could go longer and dig into all the details of team topologies, and I guess that our listeners as well would really appreciate that. But we are nearing our end of this episode and the recording time we have booked in here, so maybe that we will save those questions and sort of ask our listeners to come up with questions, and we'll see if we can invite you back on again and we can answer those.
Sounds good.
But before we end things, are there anything we have forgotten to ask you or something you want to mention, Matthew?
Just a couple of things. One, we've now got a small but expanding partner program to help around the world in different countries. So please reach out if you need some local help in local language, for example. For example, I think we've got 2 partners in Norway already, in Norwegian language. So interesting opportunity there. We have an online academy for learning. If you go to academy.teamtopologies.com, you'll find lots of really good video courses there, and people have really appreciated those. And we've just launched an approach to assessing team cognitive load called Team Pritchard. And if you do a search for that, you'll find more details. So we're trying to make these patterns and ideas come to life and be useful for organizations, kind of lots of different sizes around the world.
That's so great to hear. And I'm really looking forward to the next edition of the book that you mentioned that you are.
I've got to write it first.
So this has been a special edition of Plattformpodden with Hans Christian Flotten and Audun Faukal Strand. Our technical producer is, as always, Tore Græsdal. The newest episode, you will always find them on plattformpodden.no or your local podcast app. Please follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you. Bye.